I want you to think about the lyrics of the song that we just sang there, God Give Us Christian Homes. And upon reading those lyrics, several thoughts immediately might come to mind. My thoughts might not be yours, so you might not think the way I was thinking on this. But first of all, first thing that I saw was Christian does not really apply to the house or the physical dimensions that a person lives in. It's not your structure itself. It refers really to the people in the spiritual environment that you create. Ideally, Christian is a noun, not an adjective. Although in this context, it makes sense that the environment that we are creating, hopefully, is certainly a Christian one. The second thing that you realize is that Christian homes are not automatic. They are not accidental. They are the product of personal devotion and commitment. First, by those who head that home. Both the husband and the wife have their respective duties. And then secondly, by the children who are well taught and well disciplined to participate in that home environment. Imploring God to give us Christian homes, here's my third point, doesn't mean that if I pray for it, then it's going to happen. But rather, we're beseeching or petitioning divine intervention of God to do what we cannot do. We're asking for His grace and His mercy and His forgiveness, for His enlightenment, for His providence, the guidance of the Holy Spirit. We're not saying, it doesn't really matter what I do, God, but I ask you to create a Christian environment for me. Because that's just not going to happen by itself. In other words, it's not enough to sing the song. And it's not enough merely to desire to have a Christian home. There has to be earnestness and diligent purpose, something that you start, a plan, and then you follow through with that plan. You can't just will Christian homes into existence. And just because you may have grown up in a Christian home doesn't mean that yours automatically is one. And just because your entire family attends church does not mean that your entire family adores Jesus Christ and worships Him in their home and in their heart. And just because we surround ourselves with Bible classes and sermons and Christians does not mean that our home life automatically conforms to the Master. In other words, we want, hopefully, Christian homes, but it takes great effort and commitment and time to produce Christian homes. Asking God to give us Christian homes, then, without that effort, commitment, and time, is like a prayer asked without faith. And we know what James says about prayers that are asked without faith. They are the prayers of double-minded men. They are the prayers of those who say one thing and do another. On the one hand, a person says, I believe that you, God, ought to help me. And yet on the other hand, what they're really saying is, but I don't believe in you enough to surrender my life to you and to do what you've asked me to do. That's the prayer of a double-minded man. And don't think that just because you're a woman doesn't mean that you're exempt from that statement, okay? We're talking about people here, not just masculine beings. So I offer a challenge to you. Let 2011 be the year that you gave far more effort to achieving a Christian home than you have ever given before. I lay the gauntlet down. I challenge you with that, that you would take this lesson and the ideas of this series here to heart, and that you would do more than you've ever done. Even if your original family is grown up, or you're a grandparent and your own children are obviously grown up and moved out and now they have children, do what you're able to do in your sphere of influence to help your family through them. Even if you're a single person living by yourself, you are still responsible to have a Christian home environment. And that is not something that just happens once again because you go to church. Something that you must create. There's a responsibility here. So it's not enough to sing the song, although the song teaches us well. We have to internalize the message, because that message of the song really is the message of the gospel itself. Really is the message of the whole Bible. And that's what we want to focus on this morning. In the evangelical world, Dr. Tony Evans has a lot to say. I don't endorse all of his theology, but he certainly has some powerful messages and some powerful illustrations. One of them that you might have heard me talk about before is in his own personal experience. Years ago, he had a house that had cracks in a certain wall. And he called a contractor in to fix those cracks in his wall. And the contractor came in and remudded and repainted and fixed the cracks in the wall. And all was fine until a couple weeks later, the cracks showed up again. And so he calls in the contractor and he remuds the wall and fixes the wall and repaints the wall, and they're gone. And then a few weeks later, the cracks are there again. And now he calls in a second contractor, and the second contractor doesn't do what the first contractor did. The second contractor confronts Dr. Evans and says, "Your problem is not your wall. Your problem is you have a shifting foundation." And that shifting foundation affects the entire house. And so sometimes what we're doing, we don't mean to do it, but sometimes all we're doing is we're fixing cracks in the wall and we're failing to address the foundation issue. And if you want to do that for the rest of your life, just address cracks in the wall, in other words, chasing symptoms, then you're going to be very busy chasing those symptoms for the rest of your life, but you're never going to really address the problem. The same thing in that physical illustration is so true in the spiritual context, that if you've got problems in your life, problems in your marriage, problems in your family, problems with yourself, and I'm talking about moral problems, and you keep trying to patch it over with more Bible reading or more church going, or maybe you attend another class and you think that, you know, by all that I'm going to get better. All you're doing is masking over the problem. The cracks are still there because you haven't really addressed the real issue yet. The real issue is the foundation. And we're taught in our society, we're trained to treat symptoms and not go to the source of the problem. It happens in the field of society, in the field of medicine, in schooling, education, in our sociological problems that we have. We're constantly fixing cracks and not addressing the foundation. That's just not going to work. If we want a solid congregation or if we want a solid household, we're going to have to address the foundation issue. Just because we are a church of Christ does not mean that we are immune from shifting foundations. We cannot afford to bury our head in the sand. Being Christians does not mean that we are exempt from danger. We can still succumb to the same crises, the same problems, the same misconceptions, the same fears as the ungodly do. The difference, however, ought to be in how we deal with those problems. The ungodly deal with it out of self-sufficiency and their own resources. We are supposed to deal with it by faith and prayer. And so we're dealing with some of the same problems because the problems are human problems. But we are not just humans, we are Christians. And therefore we have a relationship with the Father. And because of that, if it is built on the foundation of Christ, if that relationship is true and genuine in Christ, well then we have a way to deal with that that others do not have. You cannot assume that because you are a Christian, therefore your family is safe. We talked about that at length last week. Satan is seeking you and your family's destruction. Remember his two objectives, and they are very clear. First of all, divide the marriage. Secondly, divide the family. He's very good at what he does. So what is your family's foundation? The foundation ought to be ideally chosen by the head of the household, the father, and supported by the wife, the mother, and laid upon Jesus Christ. That's where the foundation ought to be. We see in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, for example, verse 10 and following that Jake had read for us, we see there the idea of building a foundation upon Christ even as a congregation. That's the context of what he's talking about. He's not talking about family there, he's talking about a congregation. The foundation has to be Jesus Christ, and people are supposed to build upon that foundation. Just because they build upon it, however, doesn't mean they always build the right thing. And that's what we want to focus on as well as we go along in our series. First of all, let's deal with the foundation issue. Then let's talk about what we build upon the foundation. Any other foundation other than Christ is going to be fraught with problems, is going to shift. And there's reasons for that. It can slip off of its original footings. Anyone who's had a house do that knows exactly what I'm talking about. I've had a house slip off the footings, and then the whole house is kind of gallywampus. Not sure if that's a word or not, but it worked. And you understand what I'm talking about. The whole house suddenly is really compromised because of that. Or it can be jarred by external forces. If you think about an earthquake, for example, under the sea causes a great tsunami. It's not just the earthquake, it's the effect of the earthquake, the effects of that event there that forces another event and will jar our building, if you will, right off of its foundation. Or perhaps we're just not using the right materials. If you're not building on Jesus Christ, then your foundation's not going to last. And if you're building the wrong thing upon Jesus Christ, then that building or that structure is not going to last. So it's not just the right foundation, it's also the right building and understanding that there. So to the heads of family especially, you realize that your family gains confidence in the gospel due to the foundation that you build the family upon. There's great confidence and strength in that. You choose the foundation, and the family is all gathered around that sense of purpose and objective. And you are the one, as a head of household, to kind of gather them in that sense and to keep them focused on that objective. Because if you don't do that, you know what happens with people. We all kind of get our distractions and our own little bubbles and our own self-absorbed lives, and we just go our own directions. So it really bears upon the head of household to continue to bring the family back and say, remember what our foundation is. Remember who our foundation is. And remember our objective and the purpose for our being a family in the sight of God. It's not a popular job, by the way. Not everyone likes you talking like that. Okay? But no one said it had to be popular. It's just something that has to be done. And I'm going to be talking very pointedly in the next couple weeks about heads of household, because they have a great responsibility. If you're going to have a strong marriage and or family, you've got to have a strong head of household. It is observable across the board that any weakened marriage and or weakened family ultimately goes back to a weakened head of household in some respect or another. I'm not saying that they're responsible for every defect in that relationship. I'm saying that there is a problem with the leadership itself and that that affects the group itself. So this confidence can be manifested in your ability to guide as a godly leader, your sincerity, your integrity, your consistency, and yes, of course, the basis of your instruction, the essence, if you will, the content of your instruction. And of course, there's your ability to govern or to judge. And to judge, I don't mean that in a negative way, but rather to discern, to weigh out things righteously, if you will, justly. I've been doing a lot of study in Isaiah here lately, and one of the things that God consistently brings to Israel's and then Judah's attention is that you are not a just people. You are bribable. You look one way and another to see who's looking before you act. You compromise the people, especially the helpless. You exploit the needy. You are not a just people. So heads of household, we need to be just people. We need to govern wisely. It is our courage and our fairness as an enforcer of the law of the house that is laid down. If you lay down rules, then you enforce them fairly and, yes, justly. That doesn't mean that one child gets the brunt of everything and the other child skates on everything because they're the favored child. You never say that, but you act it out. Okay? It means that regardless of who the child is or how many you have, they are all dealt with in the same way. And that is really what we're talking about here. There are rewards and there are consequences, and they are distributed equally. There is your diligence as a provider. We're talking here about your willingness to work as well as your work ethic. Just because you're head of household doesn't mean that you're automatically a provider. Being a provider is part of the responsibility of being a head of household. Doesn't mean that you're already there. It means that that's what you're supposed to do. So you have to look at this. Am I willing to provide for my family? Am I willing to do that with good work ethic? Am I a hard worker? Am I a strong worker? Am I a fair worker? Do I give my employer everything that he or she or that entity deserves? Because your children are watching you. And if you're going to shaft your employer, so to speak, then you better believe that your children are going to pick up on that and they're going to carry that into their own family and, yes, in their own work ethic. Your faith as a child yourself to your own spiritual father. You can't expect your father to respect you, fathers, or your son and daughter, I should say, to respect you, fathers, if you don't also respect your father. So if you want your children or your family to respect you, if you're a head of household, then you show, first of all, your respect and your reverence for God. And if you aren't willing to show reverence and respect for God, then you have no one really to blame but yourself when your family does not respect you, because you set the pattern. So it's all a responsibility issue. Again, as I said last week, we cannot control everything our wives or husbands or children do. That's not what you're being asked to do, is to control their everything. But you are responsible for yourself, and part of that self-responsibility is to set a proper pattern. There's no secret here that there is a full-scale, unprecedented assault in the history of our country, anyway, of this ungodly society against the family. It's set against the family. There's a war going on. I'm not going to redo the whole lesson from last week, but you have to understand that Satan knows that this war is going on, and he's very good at conducting it. So you might ask, first of all, a question here. Is our corrupted society breaking down the family unit, or is the dysfunctional families destroying society? And there's two different ways of looking at this. If the first is correct, then it's because people are sweeping the leg from underneath what they're trying to build upon. Okay? Imagine trying to build a dock, and every pier that's put up, someone takes a chainsaw and cuts it down as you're trying to build the dock. Or you're trying to build a structure of any kind, and as you continue to build, someone's coming along with a giant wrecking ball or a sledgehammer and destroying everything, the underpinnings of that building. It's the same thing with society. Here we are trying to build a great society, and we're undercutting the very things, the family, that is the underpinnings of that society. Or we can look at it this way here, that in the second case, if the society is being destroyed by dysfunctional families, then in a sense we're rotting from the inside out. It's like a person being filled with a disease who isn't yet aware of it, but in a sense he's already dead but still walking. Kind of like what Revelation chapter 3 describes of the church at Sardis. You have a name that you're alive, but you're dead. You're just still walking is all. And so that might be it. And in my opinion, for what it's worth, I think it's the second thing. I think that our society is succumbing to the forces, if you will, of dysfunctional families. Because society is the result of families, not the other way around. But neither scenario is good, and both indicate a steady and persistent and self-serving departure from that which is right and that which is good, and that which works. There's a reason why we see problems in our society when the foundation starts shifting. There's a reason why we see the cracks, in other words. And we can't just keep addressing the cracks and ignore the foundation. Another perspective here, for what it's worth, 1947, sociologist and historian Carl Zimmerman compared the deterioration and disintegration of various empires and cultures throughout history. And he compared those things with the decline of the family unit in America. Now, keep in mind, this was in 1947. You know, when everything was right and good and there was no problems, right? Before computers and basically before TV and all that stuff. And he noted some patterns and consistencies here. And these patterns are, first of all, an increase in divorce. And in particular, he says, rapid, easy, and causeless divorce. In other words, divorce just because, you know, we're tired of each other. Secondly, decrease in the number of children. In other words, population decay or decline. Thirdly, revolts of the youth against their parents, robbing their parents of the authority that they have to govern the household. Fourthly, the elimination of the real meaning of marriage and its ceremony. In other words, the sacredness of marriage is no longer sacred. And you can just imagine, as belief in God evaporates in a society, so will the belief in what God has instituted in that society will also evaporate. Next, we have pessimism toward doctrines of the early heroes, whether it is the apostles of Christ or our American founding fathers, it doesn't matter. What we see in these kinds of societies is basically a disconnection from them or a critique of them that is either unfair or just outright selfish. And then we see breakdown of the most of the inhibitions against adultery. Adultery just isn't as bad as it used to be. In fact, it's actually tolerable as long as you can get away with it. It's kind of the attitude that you see in those kinds of cultures. And then there is the rapid rise and spread of juvenile delinquency, the rebellion against and disregard for authority, not only within the home, but even outside of the home. And then finally, there is a common acceptance of all forms of sexual perversions, immorality of all kinds. These are the cracks in the walls, but they're just symptoms. The real problem is a shifting foundation, the failure of the family unit. Look at these things here and tell me if you're not seeing this in modern America. And this was observable in 1947. It is so much more observable today in 2011. What about our own families? Men cannot say, well, we're Christian men. Of course, we are good husbands and good fathers and good leaders. I don't think that is true. I have not seen it by observation, and it is not biblically true. It is not even logically true. Okay? Being a good husband, a good father, and a good leader is something that you learn and you practice and you get better at over time if you're practicing it well. It's not something that is a given. It's not something that just happens when you say I do or have a child. Status is not the same as quality. Position is not the same as mastery of that position. I'm not accusing anyone here of having failed in that. Rather, I'm just trying to keep us from thinking that we are automatically successful just because of who we call ourselves. So don't fall into that trap that because we're men or because we're heads of household, therefore, of course, we know what to do. I don't know that that's true at all. And if we all do know what to do, then we shouldn't see any problems of the kind that we see in the brotherhood on a regular basis. If your home is not a Christian home, in other words, if it is not a sanctuary for all that is good and decent, if God is not really being honored, and if Christ is not being worshipped, and the Holy Spirit is not being followed, you cannot say something like, well, I know it's not that way now, but over time I know things will get better. Without changing anything, you are sadly mistaken. What the evolutionists do is they throw time at their problems. Have you ever noticed that? When they can't figure out how something came into being naturally, they just throw a few more million years or a billion years at it and say that, well, that ups the statistics, the probability of it happening on its own, and that's how they solve problems. I'm afraid sometimes Christians do the same thing. They throw time at their problems and hope that over time, things are going to get better. And as the problem is worsened, then we just throw more time at it, perhaps. And you realize, of course, in the natural world, time by itself is not a healer, as is often called, right? Time heals all wounds. Time by itself is actually a destroyer. If you look at the physical universe and you look at the universe over time, it did not start down here and continue to improve over time. It actually started up here and is continuing to decline over time. It's called entropy. Look it up. It's a fascinating subject, but I digress here, okay? But there is this idea of everything disintegrating rather than improving. So if you're motto or if your game plan or if your strategy is to throw time at it and say, I know my marriage isn't what it should be now, but I think in 20 years it will be, and that's your plan, you are sadly mistaken, because in 20 years it's going to have 20 years more of degradation and disintegration and destruction. It's going to be worse than it is now, not better. So don't throw the time factor in there and think that that's going to change all things. Same with your children. Don't think that, well, I know there are little hellions right now, but I think in time that they're going to turn out to be good, productive citizens and good Christians. Really, where did that come from? Exactly, right? Where did that kind of thinking come from? Throwing time at your children and then hoping that things will get better over time. It's just not going to happen. You have to train your family to become what you need them to be. You can't just hope that a Christian home will pop into existence because you have a house and people living in it. You have to create a Christian home environment. And that's going to take some time. And if you're not going to do that, then who else is going to do that? Do you think the preacher or the elder is going to come over once a week and kind of build things for you? Okay? I got my own problems, right? I mean, I've got my own responsibilities. I've got my own issues and things that I need to work on. I can't come over and fix all of yours, and neither should you come over and fix mine. But what we can do together, and this is what this series is all about, is we can educate ourselves better as to what needs to be done and then commit to what needs to be done together. And that's hopefully what we're doing this morning. It's not the congregation's job, however, to make yours a Christian home. We provide information. We collectively provide moral support. We provide good advice, I hope. But you're the ones, each one of you, are the ones who have to participate in this. From the head of household down to the children in that household, you have to participate in this. And heads of household, if you've not been focusing on these things that I'm talking about, I'm not saying that your family is not important to you. What I'm suggesting to you, if you've been neglecting these areas, is that your family is not important enough to you. Parents and heads of household, if you truly want Christian homes, and you've got to make Christ all important to you first. That's where it all begins. Can't expect your children to follow you in a noble, ultimate context there, unless, of course, you're already pursuing that yourself. So someone says, well, I want a Christian home, and I think that's an excellent endeavor. God wants you to have a Christian home. It's a win-win-win situation. You win, your family wins, and God wins when you have a Christian home. But you have to give Christ his rightful place. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. I'll be there in just a moment. Deuteronomy chapter 6. In the law of Moses, before God elaborated on government, church, military, law, and even personal hygiene, he spoke out on the family. And I want you to see that. I want you to see the importance that God laid upon the heads of household with regard to their family. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 1, and I'm going to read a few verses, so just stay with me here. Now this is the commandment, the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, Moses says, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, to keep all of his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Down to verse 13. You shall fear only the Lord your God and you shall worship him and swear by his name. Now, if that isn't emphatic, I don't know what is. It's very clear. It's crystal clear. Moses is saying to the children of Israel, before addressing all these other particulars, he's saying, fathers, especially, here is your responsibility. First of all, you do what you're supposed to do as a follower of God. And secondly, teach that to your family. Someone says, well, what's most beneficial for my family? Well, verse 4 and 5 tells it all. The Lord our God is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and might. That's what you should be teaching to your family. But that's what you must be practicing yourself as well. God must be respected and revered. He must be adored and worshipped above all else, not just during church. Luke chapter 14, verse 26, Jesus says something very similar Not in these words, but it's the same message. He says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Obviously, he doesn't mean literally to hate yourself, but in comparison to how we have him on a scale of, you know, 1 to 10, if you will, you know, he needs to be number one, and everyone else, even your father, mother, sister, brother, even your own self needs to be below that, is really in essence what he's saying. And if you won't do that, then you can't even be his disciple, much less have a Christian home. Christ must be honored and appreciated as Lord, not as a Lord, but as the Lord. Christ ought never to have to compete with other lords and gods and idols like TVs and computers and internet and hobbies and family outings and things like that. Christ should never have to compete with those things. I want you to consider the implications if a husband said to his family, wife, children, as he's standing there before them, my love for Christ is more than my combined love for each one of you. And so must yours be. Your love for Christ must be more than your love for me and your love for mom and your love for your siblings. What an impression that would leave. That does not communicate at all, I don't love you. What it communicates is, I love you so much that I'm willing to give my first love to Christ because that is in your best interest. If you give your love to Christ first, and you give your first love to Christ, then that is going to act in your family's best interest. And you're going to be fulfilling exactly what Jesus just said right here in Luke 6, 14, verse 26. One of the problems that we have today is that we have fathers and mothers who love their children more than they love Christ. We have husbands and wives who love each other more than they love Christ. We have families that love themselves as families more than they love Christ. And you look at that and you say, well, it's all good and well, isn't it? It's a noble thing to love, right? It is a good thing to love, but it's a misplaced love, and it's the wrong kind of love, and it's a love not in the right priority. Remember our other lesson we talked about a couple weeks ago, returning to our first love, our most important love. And furthermore, we must allow the Holy Spirit to guide and to govern our lives. We cannot claim this and yet fail to submit and follow Him. Romans chapter 8, verse 5, those who are according to the flesh, or the world, or worldly men, if you want, set their minds on the things of the flesh. Those who are according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. It's very clear. And this setting our mind on the Spirit must be real and definable. It's got to be something that your wife or your husband and your children can see in you. It's not something you just talk about. It's something that has to be seen in you. This cannot remain, in other words, ink on a page. There has to be a living message by which your heart and mind are governed. Furthermore, the entire family has to understand the meaning, and you must be the one who teaches by example. You say, that's a lot of responsibility. Yes, it is. And God will equip you to carry out that responsibility if you do what He says to do. Overall, the family needs to be taught to have a relationship with God, not just about Bible or Bible verses or facts and stories, which is sometimes what parents do. They mean well, but all they teach is Bible stories. It's great to teach your children Bible stories. They need to learn that. They need to learn the lessons and the moral lessons that come from those stories. But you are not converting them to Bible stories. You need to use those lessons to convert them to Christ and bring them closer to God, and not just marry them to a religion, but marry them to the Lord, so to speak. And that requires some honest and accurate information, and it also requires working and dynamic role models, and it requires this to be done at every age level. In other words, age-appropriate instruction. You don't teach a 4-year-old the same way you teach a 17-year-old, I hope, and vice versa. So make it age appropriate. If you've got young children, well, then start very basic and very simple. If you've got older children, well, then hopefully it will be more complex. But you're teaching them at the level that they can understand, and you're teaching them some very basic things with more complexity as time goes on, such as who God is in the first place. without being all cute and fluffy and ambiguous about it. You're being serious yet realistic. Once again, age appropriate. You want to teach him why God cares about us. The gospel is a story of love and hope and victory. It is not a story of doom and condemnation. So depending on how you teach it, is how they're going to see the gospel for the first time. Don't teach it wrongly. Do your best to teach it accurately, as best as you're capable of doing. Present it as a message of love and hope and victory with zeal and sincerity. We are to teach one another what he does for us. The gospel accounts, yes, but also the spiritual concepts in those accounts. Grace and mercy and forgiveness, as well as joy and gratitude and peace. In other words, you're not teaching a textbook here. You're talking about the one with whom we want to spend our eternity, right? The textbook, so to speak, is teaching us how we are to regard that one, who he is, and why he is, and why he loves us, and so on. But we're not here to be students of the book. And I'm afraid that we've been misguided sometimes in that. We are to understand, and our families are to understand, how we need Christ so desperately. We do not reach for him and trust in Jesus only when there is a crisis at hand. We are always desperate for him, and we are certainly desperate without him. We need him every day for every occasion, good and bad, sickness and health, times of joy as well as times of sorrow. Need to teach your children that balanced perspective. Otherwise, they're going to think that Jesus is the great Band-Aid Redeemer, that he only helps us when we're in trouble, and we're very rarely in trouble because we take care of ourselves all the rest of the time. If you're conveying that message to your children, no wonder that they're going to become one of those statistics that I talked about last week. 80 to 85% of all children leave the Lord by the time they're in college. You also need to teach the benefits and the rewards, the sorrows and the punishments. In other words, you need to teach them about heaven, but you also need to teach them about hell. Not one without the other. There needs to be a balance. You understand that God is a God of balance. God is a God of salvation. He is also a God of judgment. And it depends on how we respond to what he gives to us as to whether we receive salvation or judgment. But the same thing, or those two things rather, come from the same God. Let's turn over to Philippians chapter 4 for a moment. Philippians chapter 4, this is a well-known passage. And therefore, we should be familiar with it already for different reasons. But in this particular case, I want you to think about Philippians 4, verse 8 and 9, in context of what we're talking about. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, pure, lovely, good repute, if there is any excellence, and if anything worthy of praise, meditate or dwell on these things. The things which you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, he says, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. Here is a principle, in essence, that we teach loudest by our actions, not by our words. No hands, please, but how many of us might have had fathers who talked a lot about being Christian, but you didn't really see it in their lives? They weren't really the example that they needed to be. We need to talk, yes, but we also need to show it. The first impression our family has of God, our young ones have of God, comes from especially the father of that family. That's their first impression of God. Make it a good impression, in other words. And if you're going to have a Christian home, then you have to, that Christian home has to have Christian mentors, Christian role models, Christian leaders. That is our adult responsibility. Suppose a wife or a child is responding to this in their heart and saying, well, I'm not the head of household, I have no control. But you can have a right vision. Even if you can't control the household, you can at least have the right heart and the right vision. And especially to children, I would say, you know now what God wants of your household when you have it. So start working in that direction. Start preparing in your heart right now to say that I will have a godly household. I will purpose in my heart to do what I can. Maybe my family let me down. Maybe they didn't do what they were supposed to do. I can't change that, but I can change my family. And I hope that you have that resolve. God, give us Christian homes. God's not going to give anything, of course, unless we believe that he's willing and capable of giving that. And then we live like we believe. I want you to just consider again the words of the song that we just sang. Homes where the Bible is loved and taught. Homes where the Master's will is sought. Homes crowned with beauty, thy love hath wrought. God, give us Christian homes. Homes where the Father is true and strong. Homes that are free from the blight of wrong. Homes that are joyous with love and song. God, give us Christian homes. Homes where the mother in queenly quest strives to show others thy way is best. Homes where the Lord is an honored guest. God, give us Christian homes. Homes where the children are led to know Christ in his beauty who loves them so. Homes where the altar fires burn and glow. God, give us Christian homes. Does this describe your home? No hands, please, but does this describe your home environment? And if it's not describing your home, then what can you do to improve that scenario? Let this be a time of rededication, recommitment, and renewal. Be honest with yourself. Take inventory. Take a good, long, hard look at yourself and your home environment and the message that you preach through your example. Someone says, I'm looking at all this and it's too much for me. And you are correct. It is too much for any of us by ourselves. That's why we trust in God, pray to him, and surrender our heart to him and follow what he says to do. And even if you look at your home life and say, I've got a pretty good home life. We've got a good Christian home. Well, then I would admonish you to excel still more, like Paul did with the Thessalonians. There's still more that could be done. You can still do better. Don't stop now. Let that be our lesson for this morning. If there's anyone here this morning who is touched by that lesson or touched by the gospel message at all, needs to come forward and dedicate their life to Christ in baptism or other spiritual needs that you might have, this would be the time in our service where it would be appropriate for you to respond by coming forward as we stand and sing the song Richard has selected for us.